The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
In thinking about what to talk about today, in my mind, I was reflecting that the talks I've been giving both Sunday and Monday here at IMC for January were perhaps somewhat more philosophical or doctrinal, more by the teachings, the fundamental teachings of Buddhism with the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And they're meant to be practical, but they can maybe appear not so practical in that form. And I thought, well, what can I talk about today to make amends? About something that's very, you know, really practical, kind of bring the mindfulness right down to the, you know, the day-to-day activities of our life. And I thought I would give a talk on mindfulness of eating. And I'm hoping to do it in such a way that some of the ideas of mindfulness will come through there, and then you can take, this is just an example of eating, just an example of how mindfulness then can be applied in all kinds of areas of our life. And in doing it, you'll see as we talk about it, I want to make the point that there are two general ways of doing mindfulness practice, or two general domains of mindfulness. And often we focus a lot here on the first domain, but as we get into the second half of the talk, I want to let you know about the second domain, where it becomes actually richer and broader than the first, in some ways. And it's quite common for us when we teach retreats, like at Spirit Rock, to give some instructions in mindfulness of eating. We give instructions in mindfulness of breathing, posture, walking meditation. And eating is a big part of what we do, so we give instructions for mindfulness of eating. And the spirit there is that we want to bring all our activities on the retreat into the fold of mindfulness, into the field of mindfulness. And eating is an important part. Most people spend three periods of time each day eating. And it's a wonderful place to practice mindfulness of eating because these retreats are done in silence. So it's not so common for people to have a silent period of time to eat. Some people will talk when they're eating, either to others or on the phone, or they have the television on, or they're reading the newspaper or doing something, rather than just being fully present for the food. And so it turns out retreats are a really beautiful place to cultivate a very different relationship to eating and food than most people have a chance to do in their normal life. For me, my introduction to the mindfulness of eating was practicing Zen, where during retreats, most of the eating is done in the meditation hall. So imagine we were all going to have dinner here, lunch together here. And so, it's beautifully done in Zen. I believe it's beautifully done. Some people don't think so, as their knees hurt. Because you sit in meditation posture. And in the Zen tradition I practiced in, we sat meditating facing the wall. And then we would turn around and face out into the middle of the hall in order to have our meal. And there'd be a meal board, like a strip of wood in front of you that was called a meal board. It was treated like your table. You would never put your foot on it or stand on it. And then you'd have these three bowls that were nestled inside of each other. They were wrapped up in a cloth with a nice little knot on top. Kind of like the thing that you have at the end of your stick if you run away from home. That kind of. And then in that silence of the meditation hall, you would chant a little bit. And then after the chant, you would open up these bowls and lay them all out. And just you and the bowls. You're really present for those. And you lay them out. And then there's a whole choreographed way of eating. It takes a while to learn Zen, how to choreograph all the steps and forms. And some people are a little bit oppressed by it. It seems so formal and arbitrary and artificial. What I found is once you get the hang of it, it's quite beautiful. It's like a dance. It's kind of like an art, like the tea ceremony. And my fantasy, my understanding was my sense of it was it was the most efficient way of eating, most elegantly efficient way of eating, with the minimum amount of extra movements. Just, you know, whatever you needed, you know, the minimum amount of movements in order to put out your plates, serve yourself, eat, clean your bowls, because you have to clean them. Everything got, the bowls got clean too in the meditation hall. They'd come and serve you water, and you'd have a whole system of cleaning it, and then you'd wrap it all up. And there was often a lot of waiting. You're waiting for the food to be served, waiting for everyone to be served. You know, sometimes there were 40, 50 people there, so you have to wait for everyone to be served before you could start. And so there's a lot of waiting, and you're waiting as food in front of you, and you're looking at it. There were servers who came in, and there was bowing to the servers, and it was quite beautiful to do. So I learned a lot about the beauty of mindfulness of eating in that kind of form, that setting. When I was also at the Zen Center, the abbot there at that time was fond of, especially for people who are priests, people who are, you know, more engaged in the practice than maybe others, to suggest that they go study tea ceremony, Japanese tea ceremony. And some of you might have done it or seen it. And there's something, I've been a few times to tea ceremony, and it has some of the same qualities of eating and meditation in the Zen meditation hall, of eating meditation hall, of this kind of care and presence to what you're doing. But the added dimension of the tea ceremony, of watching it, is that part of it, as a guest, you're watching the person serving tea and offering your tea, and it's done with great care, with a great mindfulness and attention to all the little details. And you get a sense the person is doing it, that they're fully present for lifting up a tea bowl. It isn't like lifting up one hand to here, you know, kind of like talking about something else. That the most centrally important thing at the moment for that person is lifting up the tea bowl with two hands as if it's a precious thing and leaning forward. And the most important thing in the next moment is to really offer it to you. And if you feel a presence and care and attention, like all their attention is offering it to you. Or in making the tea, all their attention goes into pouring the water into the cup, or pouring the ground tea, in, you know, picking it up and putting it in. And this care that's given in. And I found it, I wouldn't say mesmerizing, but quite captivating for my attention to watch and be present for someone who offers their care and attention so carefully. It's kind of like watching perhaps a master athlete or a gymnast. It just seems so beautiful and elegant to watch. But it was something different than an athlete for me, because there was a quality of the silent attention, this fullness of attention. And it wasn't just watching it. I believe that there's a kind of resonance that goes on inside of us sometimes. Nowadays they talk about mirror neurons. But there's resonance that goes on where in watching this person being so fully intent and concentrated and so little ego, so little attachment, so many extra going on, it kind of resonates with something inside of me that also then felt very peaceful and settled and still. Like my, you know, the world outside the tea room falls away. And there's something really beautiful about the sense of being a peace, of presence, of attention, of clarity, of falling away of distractions, and just being fully there for this thing. And in tea ceremony, you're guided into that by this master meditator who's kind of doing this tea ceremony one step at a time and kind of going along and entering into it. So whether it's in a meditation hall or retreat or a tea ceremony or at your own home, at your own dining table, there's an opportunity in eating of not just eating and nourishing yourself and bringing pleasure to yourself, but actually to use eating as a time to cultivate a deeper attention, a deeper presence, a deeper concentration that brings, hopefully, a very deep sense of well-being, so that you feel really connected and present and concentrated. And one of the things we're doing in mindfulness practice is learning how to bring mindfulness to all our life, not only to understand our life, but to also start cultivating kind of an inner movement, inner presence, an inner concentration, inner well-being, that it becomes more valuable, perhaps, than what we do. The tea is nice. It was nice to have the tea. You know, I liked having the tea. It was nice. Actually, sometimes I didn't. Sometimes I didn't like the green tea. But in any case, the tea was nice, but that was like excuse for having this very wonderful presence and peace and well-being that came. And it could have been done some other way. a friend of mine who was a woman, is a woman, in Japan. There's a very serious Zen student in Japan, been there for maybe 30 years now. And she studied with a very famous Zen master who was mostly trained in his monastery, which was an all-male monastery. But he opened the doors to the monastery for her to come in every day, and she would go there and train with the monks and have interviews with him. But she wasn't allowed to live there because it was an all-male monastery, relatively small. And he was concerned that she wasn't getting the full training that the monks were getting because she wasn't living there. And he wanted to provide her with something comparable for her training. And what he did was he said, when you're not here, go over, I think it was Bizen is the name of the town, to Bizen in Japan and study pottery. And the practice of pottery, of throwing a wheel, throwing clay and a wheel and that kind of engagement, the way it's done, he saw as being comparable to the kind of training that a monk gets in a monastery. Again, it was kind of the presence, the engagement. And it takes a long time to learn how to be fully present to, in a way to, you know, turn clay in a wheel and make a bowl. And again, it has to do with the presence we offer is important, and much more than the activity. Many of us eat a good part of the day. It'd be interesting to add up how many minutes or hours we spend somehow connected with food, whether it's shopping or cooking or eating and cleaning up. It's a fair amount of our time. And it's been said that next to breathing, it's one of the primary things that people are involved in every day, somehow consuming. I find it very interesting that the mouth and somehow is associated with some of the most important things that people spend their time doing. Breathing, mouth and the nose. And we use the breath as a foundation for mindfulness practice, for spirituality. Talking, you know, big area of mindfulness. Turns out that mindfulness of talking is one of the most difficult places to practice mindfulness, but also one of the most important. And then also the eating and drinking comes through the mouth. And it's also been said that mindfulness of eating is the second most difficult place to practice mindfulness. Maybe it's not true for everyone, but it can be quite difficult to do it. So the practical aspects of mindfulness of eating are pretty simple. If you really want to do it well and carefully, use it as a meditation practice, like on retreat especially, but even at home, it's really helpful that you eat without eating, you eat without speaking. So be silent. And if you've never done it in your life, it's strongly recommended that you take one meal, try it out, and see what it's like to eat without talking, but without any other distractions, where the purpose here is to really offer your attention fully to what you're doing, to the food and to the eating, to that process. Don't speak, don't be distracted, just do that one thing fully. Some people find it hard, actually, and to eat in a careful, mindful way. I'm a fast eater, faster than people would expect, being all my years of practice. But it used to be faster. So you have to kind of see where I came from. And so fast that in a Zen monastery, where it's notorious that they have to eat fast there, because they come with seconds, but you have like, they serve you first, and then they have like 5 minutes or something before, but to finish that before they come with seconds. And if you don't, you know, if you're not ready for seconds, you don't get any. Some people are naturally slow eaters and found very difficult this whole fast eating Zen. For me, I had to slow down. For the Zen, I was eating, I ate that fast. But in order to help me slow down and be really present, one of the things I did was I started eating with my left hand. I'm right-handed. And so we had chopsticks and we had spoons. And that encouraged me to really be present there for it and be mindful and more careful of what I did and be there in a nice way. I also found it helpful, especially when I started doing Vipassana retreats, to put my fork or spoon down between bites. Because otherwise I'd find that, you know, I take a bite, pick up some food and fork, put it in my mouth, and then start chewing, and then get another, while I'm chewing, take another forkful, and have the fork of food hovering in front of my mouth, waiting for the chance to go in there. And so I would put the fork down, the spoon down, and then I'd really savor, be the present for the chewing, the tasting, the swallowing, really take it in. And then I wouldn't pick up the fork as soon as I finished swallowing, as if, you know, that was the most important thing to do as quickly as possible. I would just linger a little bit and just feel what I felt like. Feel the hunger that remained, feel the desire for more food, feel the impulse that was there, feel what's going on for me and what has shifted with that bite. And then once I'd done that checking in, then I'd take the next bite and do the same thing with that. And in the process of doing that, I learned a lot about myself. And this is one of the reasons why mindfulness of eating is helpful. It's helpful not only for the presence we bring, which hopefully if you do it really well and well-trained in eating, that it can be like a tea ceremony, have that kind of value. But you also, part of the value is we learn about ourselves. And there's a lot of desire and different kinds of desire, urges and neurosis that can go into eating for some people. So one of the things, for example, is that it's fairly common for people to eat for other reasons besides being hungry. People eat because they're lonely, they eat for pleasure, they eat for distraction, many things. And so to pay careful attention to what's going on inside of us as we eat allows us to see these impulses and then to hopefully give us a chance to be free in relationship to them, to not give in to them compulsively or automatically or unconsciously. But take time, oh, look at that. I'm quite full, I'm quite happy, I'm not hungry, but I still have this tremendous desire for pleasure. It's a drive for pleasure. So what's the drive for pleasure about? And some people will not want to question it because it's such a good thing, pleasure. But to stop and look and question, what is this drive for pleasure about? What's driving it? Where's it rising out of? What are the emotions that are connected to it? Is it out of loneliness? Is it out of greed? Is it out of status? Is it out of showing off? Is it a lot of different things can go into eating? Is there deep loneliness? Part of my kind of drive to eat fast, and for a while when I was in my early 20s, I used to overeat a lot. And when I looked at it, and I found out that I had this kind of, I don't know where I got it from, but this kind of very subtle belief that I didn't even see in the surface of my mind. It took a lot of attention to see it for me. This attitude of scarcity, that I'd better eat as much as I could now because I didn't know when I would ever eat again or have again. You know, next time there wouldn't be enough food. And so I would stuff myself and then I'd feel terrible. And so I got to see that kind of very subtle idea or attitude that was there in the background. So I also found out that because I ate so quickly, that I seldom enjoyed the food. And I learned by eating slowly how much pleasure there is in food. So some people linger with the pleasure and are attached to it, but some people don't avail themselves of the pleasure ever. And so I learned by staying and being present, even something really simple had much more flavor in it than I imagined. I did eating meditation once for kids. I taught it to kids. And of all the meditations I taught the kids, it was the one they liked the most. And I was a little bit surprised by that. But they were kind of surprised by all the different flavors and textures and that came out, the taste that came out as they ate. Partly, you know, what I did with the kids was I covered over the various bowls of different kinds of food and then had them close their eyes. And then I'd put it in their mouth. And they'd have to tell me what it was and really be present and taste it carefully. But the choice of things was, I think I had mango and strawberry and chocolate. So they liked it. But, you know, there's a lot there, a lot of pleasure there. But there's a kind of pleasure or satisfaction that I find in eating, which is when I'm really carefully paying attention to follow and track the energy or the alertness in my body. I find that when I'm hungry, even though I might be uncomfortable in some way, there's also an energetic alertness. I'm trying to charge it up a little bit. And then if I'm very careful to notice what's happening inside of me as I eat, there'll come a point where that shifts. And that sense of kind of alert desire is no longer there. And I feel satisfied. But if I had to eat any more, even one bite more, I can feel the shift to my energy starting to drain. Trying to kind of, my energy actually kind of being kind of moved towards more retired or drained or kind of heavy in a way that's not uplifting. And if I don't pay attention, I'm quite capable of eating beyond that point and then afterwards saying, oh, I feel so, you know, tired. And if you go to a meditation retreat and you end up meditating afterwards, you know, nodding off, you know, falling, can't stay awake, sometimes it's because of overeating. And so I learned to watch that tipping point in my appetite. And I learned that it's really, there's a tremendous satisfaction, delight, in not going beyond the tipping point to starting feeling heavy. And I learned to identify that point and really enjoy it. It's a very nice feeling. And I'm encouraged to stay there because there is a lot of food in my environment. I can say, well, if I get hungry in 2 hours or 3 hours, I can snack. So I just kind of wait. I'd rather keep this feeling than kind of overdo it here. So probably you can fill in this further for yourself, all the different things you can imagine learning about yourself and your relationship to desire, pleasure, loneliness, a lot of different things, discomfort, distraction, that come into play while you eat. And in fact, one of the very powerful places to practice is if you choose to do mindfulness of eating, say to eat in silence for one day or a couple of days or one meal a week, you know, a week or some kind of way. Pay very careful attention to all the protests or all the strong voices inside that say, well, not now, or this is kind of silly, this is kind of simplistic, there's more important things to do. Because those voices and those arguments are very important to look at and engage in a responsible, clear way. Because, for a number of reasons, because sometimes our minds, our lives are driven by those kinds of arguments that are often unconscious, but it come into the foreground, into consciousness, by listening to them and engaging with them and not giving in to them. And also because if you have strong arguments in your mind for why being fully present and at peace here and now is not a worthy endeavor, you better look at that carefully. What is it? Why wouldn't be fully present and peaceful here and now not be a valuable thing to do with a person's life? You know, a tea teacher spends a lifetime cultivating that presence in tea. And you can actually take very expensive tea classes where they'll teach you how to do that. Mm-hmm. Or you could just not talk during a meal at home. And train, use eating at home as a training for that. So that's one whole area, domain of mindfulness. It has to do with the domain of what happens when you bring full presence to here and now as you do something. To the sensations, the experiences, the thoughts, the feelings, everything has to do with here and now. And we really focus a lot on that on retreats. There's a whole other area, domain of mindfulness. One hand, mindfulness can mean something like non-reactive presence to what's happening now, clear attention to what's happening here and now. But mindfulness also means a kind of wider attention or care to what's happening in our life, contemplation of our life, a wider consideration of what's going on that's wider than simply what's happening here and now. So if I take this glass of water, I could practice careful mindfulness. I can pick it up the glass with two hands. I can appreciate the glass. I could feel the coolness of the glass against my hands. I can feel my thirst, dryness in my mouth. And then I could feel the desire, feel the intention. I can check out the intention and say, well, am I greedy for water or am I trying to somehow settle that thirst? See that it's a settling of the thirst and pick up the glass and touch my lips. And even before the water goes there, I can feel the sensations of the glass against my lips. And then I can take a sip and feel that and feel what happens to me. That's one whole way. Another way is I can pick up the glass of water and I can look at the glass and I can think, Hetch Hetchy. You know, Hetch Hetchy is the reservoir that we get our water from. And then I can start considering all those pipes and the pumps and the engineers and the snowfall in the Sierras that melts and goes into Hetch Hetchy. And then there's global warming. And the global warming comes right back to how I use my car. And in that glass of water, as I consider the association of things that are connected to it, that bring it to me, it gets to be the whole world at some point. And part of mindfulness is also to give it the appropriate time and place, some careful consideration to the world that this event, this situation, these things we use are connected to. And not only, and I think in a wise spiritual life or any kind of wise life, is to also feel some responsibility to that connection. Not just to say, well, I deserve this water, the water is given to me, and you know, I can do whatever I want with it. But to feel that what I do with my life has an impact on the world and on others. And that how I flush my toilets has an impact. Do we even know where our poop goes? Are we responsible for it? Or out of sight, out of mind? Where does our water come from? Where does our food come from? And so part of mindfulness of eating is to take the food that we eat as a window, as a doorway into exploring our interconnectedness with this wide world that we're in. And how far are we willing to take that exploration? And how much responsibility will we take, or how much lessons do we take from that, is an open question. And something I hope everyone will consider and explore. Some people will only explore where their food comes from to the degree that they want to make sure the food comes from a clean source. There's no mercury in their fish, or no pesticide in the milk that they drink or something. And some people want to feel that their life, the way they live their life, is a life that contributes to the world. That somehow how we live in the world, we tread lightly, we don't cause as little damage as possible. And more than that, we'd like to our presence, our lifetime also contributes to the world. Wouldn't it be nice if we left the world in a better place than we found it, in our little corner? And so how do we participate in the world? How are we participants in this local world, national world, international world, cosmic world? How do we participate? How are we citizens? And so food is one of those ways we feel that those chains of connections that ripple out from us. And it's quite, I think, lovely in many ways that it doesn't take a lot of consideration to realize that there's this web that spreads out from us through our food and what we consume out into, you know, so much of the world and so many different people. And just to consider, which I do sometimes, who are the people who handle the food that I'm eating now? And sometimes if I drop a raisin on the floor, who is it that picked that grape off the off the vine? Well, maybe it was a machine, but and who operated the machine? You know, or who is it that milked that cow? You know, that cow, you know, whose field was it grazing in? Or, you know, who was the person who trucked it? You know, I used to be a dairy farmer, so I know some of the things that's involved with, delivering the milk, and the milk trucks come, and, I used to go along sometimes to the dairy where the milk was delivered and got to see what was there and the people who were there and the cartons the milk was put in. And, you know, it was this beautiful, it was all this whole world. I know this is maybe silly to say. I once even slept underneath the loading dock of a dairy. The cement asphalt underneath the loading dock. It was raining, so I was hitchhiking around and just happened to come. I was dropped off from this big dairy factory or whatever. The loading dock was the driest place. So, you know, what is it we touch with our food? What is it we touch with what we consume? And how do we take responsibility for that? How do we participate in this world as we feel that connection? And I think that sometimes the way that mindfulness is only taught in its first domain, paying attention to here and now and the details, your sensations and what's happening here, that it could, in a sense, contribute to a consumer society. Or it could contribute to a kind of myopia. It can reinforce a certain kind of myopia that many people in our society have. Many people in our society don't consider the impact that their life has. They don't consider where things come from and how they buy things and what they buy has impact. Spreading, it spreads out from them into the world around. It makes a difference. You know, for example, if you buy local, if you buy far away. And how does it make a difference? Do we want to support local as opposed to far away? And so part of mindfulness is this part, is consideration of the impact and the relationships. And so as we eat mindfully in Buddhism, we have these two sides. We have the side of the practice here and now, and we have the side of our relationship to the world. And in different times, we might focus on these two different aspects. Sometimes we focus on here and now and use that as a training and find tremendous peace, the kind of still, beautiful, clean peace that you'd find perhaps in a tea room during a tea ceremony, that you can find in your own kitchen. And perhaps you also can find it, and other times we focus more on the relationship we have to the world around us that we have through the food that we eat. It's a rich world, and I could go on, talk more about it, but we have 5 minutes left, and maybe this is a time if some of you have some questions or comments.
When we go to a Vipassana monastery or here, we offer food to the monks. And I was wondering if you have any sense of the difference that in Zen, it's more that you offer, it's not like more hierarchical, like our tradition.
Oh, so in the Theravada tradition, when there are monastics, monks or nuns generally only eat if food is offered to them. If no one offers them food, then they don't eat. And so if they come here to IMC, the most common way in which they will eat is that sometimes they have, they sit there with a bowl, or stand with a bowl, and people put food in their bowl. And in the Zen, they don't have it that way. In Zen monasteries, it's the monks who serve themselves. But you're still being served. So being served is a big part of in Zen monasteries, and it's beautiful to be a server. I feel like I need to sneeze, so. Mindful sneezing. And so you're being served, and serving is a beautiful thing. It's beautiful to be served because you have a little different relationship to your food if it's being served to you. And so even if, so what I learned also in the Zen monastery was that when we ate informally, occasionally we'd eat in the dining room and we have, you know, kind of a regular kind of dining room kind of set up with food, was that we had a custom there that people wouldn't serve themselves there either, but we'd be mindful of each other and notice if someone was finished or looked like they needed something, and then you'd offer to serve them. So they're kind of serving each other. And so that's a whole mindfulness thing itself and a very valuable thing. But part of being a receiver in the Zen monastery, we were taught there, was you're never allowed to say no. And the spirit behind that was it was being offered. People's goodwill was offering you something. And it was kind of a disrespectful thing to say no if someone was offering you something. And that was partly a training to always say yes. And you could get around a little bit because you could go like this. Hold your fingers together, really close together, so that it would just show you want just a little bit. And some people are really adamant. You know, some people have allergies. Like I had a wheat allergy when I was in the monastery, so it was really important that I not have wheat. And so I would make it really clear that a little I wanted. A little. And some of the servers understood and, you know, would, you know, accommodate. Some of them didn't quite understand and plop it in anyway. And then I had this, what am I doing now? And but the idea was to always receive, and the way it impacted me in my own training was I learned to appreciate much more when people make an offering or offer something, and much more willing to kind of entertain the idea, well, how can I say yes to this? How can I receive this rather than somehow put a stop to it? And because I feel the beauty of the offering Whereas before the Zen training, I was much more inclined just to, you know, to be about me, myself, and mine. Well, I don't want that, thanks. You know, you know, it's kind of blow it away because I didn't want it. But now I feel the generosity. And so I don't know if that answered your question.
There's a little more of why don't we do the offering. It's just interesting that in Zen that offering is done very ceremoniously, but in ours doesn't seem to be.
Oh, on Vipassana retreats.
Right.
On Vipassana retreats, we don't serve ourselves. We could, but we generally don't, because the Vipassana retreats are designed to be as simple as possible, to have as little social interaction as possible, because in the form that we're practicing in, the particular Vipassana form we're practicing in that setting, it's not a full training, it's just a particular way where you're trying to develop a lot of concentration, a lot of stillness, a lot of presence, where you're not being ruffled or distracted by social interactions or a lot of activity. So it's designed to minimize the amount of activity, extra activity, and social interaction as you can. And when you serve, there's a social interaction that happens when you serve. And it's not always beautiful. So in the Zen monastery, for example, where I was being served, the servers would come along and they'd bow to you, and you'd bow to them before they would serve you. They're holding the pot, they bow, they put the pot down, they bow. They would, you know, serve the food to you. They'd bow. They pick up the pot. They'd bow. In Zen, when in doubt, bow. There's a lot of bowing. And so I'd be sitting there, meditating, you know, and the person would come along with the food, and they'd bow. And that person didn't bow deep enough. I think that person's dismissive of me. That person doesn't really like me. That bow didn't was that bow was disrespectful. You know, all the stuff, you know, would go on. And it's bad enough in a Vipassana retreat where the person next to you, you know, is behind you in line. You know, I think that person's crowding me, you know. Or I'm not going fast enough. Or still, there's thoughts, right? And all that stuff is important for practice. But for better or worse, the way that our Vipassana retreats have been designed is we've tried to minimize the amount just for the purposes of keeping things simple. But here, we could do it here. Mm-hmm. You know, when we have potlucks here, we could serve. It could be nice. So it's time. So if some of you have questions still, you're welcome to come up and ask them up here. And I hope that you enjoy your eating. And if, don't get oppressed by this talk, but are inspired. And you will find that eating is a doorway into your freedom and deep sense of peace as well. So thank you.